Mira woke early the next morning and went at once to the terraces above the house, feeling a grim kind of gladness that the flask of coffee she'd prepared the night before was barely tepid by the time she reached her planting site, and sat down on a stump to drink it, looking out at the dawn-tipped mountains above the steely surface of the lake, and imagining herself in jail. She imagined a cell without a window, and an open toilet, and bars worn shiny smooth in the places that a pair of grasping hands would go. She imagined clockwise laps around a concrete yard, and maggots in her food, and eczema and chilblains, and a new hacking cough, and a dead-eyed cellmate with a buzz cut and a nasty grin. She imagined her parents on visiting day, huddled together behind a pane of glass, her mother putting her hand over her mouth in shock when Mira was escorted out to them between a pair of guards, thin, broken, her complexion dull and waxy, her hair hanging lank over one eye. Her father saying, "Oh, sweetheart, not again." As she sat down and they saw the bruises on her face that she'd been trying to hide from them, bruises from where her cellmate had. "Stop it," Mira said aloud, shaking her head to dispel the fantasy, ashamed that yet again she had caught herself indulging in imaginary scenarios where she was the one who'd been injured, where she was the one who'd been wronged. This time by an invented cellmate in a fictitious future circumstance in which her parents were not only weirdly back together, but united in expressing their concern and helpless tragic love for her, and not their unmitigated horror, not their loathing, not the unspeakable revulsion they would feel when they discovered what their daughter, their little girl, had done. What she was still doing, what she'd been doing all week and all weekend, as the corpse of the man whose death she'd helped to bring about, whose death she'd helped to cover up, had been cut from the wreckage of the burned-out SUV and zipped into a body bag and put on a plane and unloaded at a morgue and pumped full of chemicals and wheeled into a fridge and wheeled out again to be formally identified by his wife, maybe, or by one of his children, or using his dental records if his face had been too badly burned in the crash that never really happened, the crash he'd never caused. The crash that Lemoyne had somehow staged, at short notice, apparently successfully, and surely not entirely on his own. Mira thought about the empty house in Thorndyke, and the man who had come to fix the windscreen on the van. She thought about the soldier up the service road, and how Lemoyne had said, "That's one of mine." She thought about Lemoyne's late wife. And then she thought, "You're doing it again." She shook her head, disgusted at herself. She was still looking for a villain. She was still trying, desperately and uselessly, to find somebody more monstrous and despicable than her. The funeral was at 11. She'd observe a minute's silence, she thought, or say a prayer, if she could think of what to pray. She poured the last of the coffee into the dirt and shook the empty flask until it was dry. She'd brought with her a banana and a snack bar for her breakfast, but it gave her a penitential feeling to be hungry, and so she left them on the stump beside the empty flask and went to fetch her fork and trowel, telling herself that she'd spend the morning weeding the pumpkins and courgettes, and the afternoon constructing trellises for the several crops of beans that were coming up and would soon become top-heavy. Stomach growling, she began shuffling along the row on the old hot water bottle she used as a kneeling pad, stopping every now and then to stretch her back and shake the stiffness out of her hands. She had reached the end of her second row of pumpkins when she felt the air go still and smelled a sudden, minerally, earthy, dusty scent that seemed to clarify the leaves and shoots of all the living things around her. It was about to start shucking down, she realized, cursing inwardly, for she couldn't bear the thought of returning to the shearing shed to spend the rest of the day in cozy company, chatting about nothing in particular and laughing at other people's jokes. Would she draw too much attention to herself if she continued working in the rain? She looked directly upward. The sky was lowering even as she watched. Maybe she could head out in the van and run some errands, she thought, as the earth around her darkened with a few splashing drops that thickened and then intensified into a deluge. She could make a day of it. Head out to the nearest hardware store to fetch a few more bales of pea straw and a load of blood and bone and whatever else they didn't really need. "Might make more sense if I go alone," she imagined saying to the others casually, swinging the keys. "I can fill the front seat that way." She remembered that the petrol tank was almost empty. Even better then, even more reason to leave. The rain was really pounding now. Mira put up her hood and dashed back to the stump to collect her breakfast and the empty flask, bent almost double, pulling off her gardening gloves and reaching out a hand even before she got to the place she knew the flask would be. Except it wasn't. The stump was clear, the surface dark and slick, She circled it, thinking that she must have knocked it into the grass somehow when she got up. But she couldn't have disturbed the banana and the bar as well. She would have noticed. And she was positive she'd left them all right there. She could visualize them perfectly. The banana, the snack bar, and the flask. All three. She looked up, squinting through the rain. And there, at the edge of the field, standing partially concealed behind a tree trunk and the shelter belt of pines, was Tony. Mira was too surprised even to speak. He put his finger over his lips and then made the sign for phone, putting his thumb to his ear and stretching his little finger down to his mouth. Then he turned his hand palm up to indicate a question. "Where's your phone?" he mouthed to her. Dumbly, Mira reached into her pocket to pull it out and show it to him, but he signaled violently for her to put it back again, then put his finger over his lips a second time and beckoned. He was performing all these actions with the same hand, and as Mira came closer through the rain, she saw that his other arm was in a kind of sling. He looked desperately unwell. His beard was ragged, and there were purple hollows under his eyes. She came closer still and saw that he was holding her flask beneath his broken arm. Now he pinned it underneath his elbow, unscrewed the lid with his free hand, and held it out to her, gesturing for her to put her phone inside. "Tony, what the fuck?" she whispered. But he shook his head, not speaking until she had dropped her phone into the flask with a clunk, and he'd replaced the cap and screwed it tight. He was leaning heavily against the tree. She looked down and saw that his left foot was swaddled in a bandage that was soaking wet and black with dirt. "I got lost," he said at last, his voice rasping in his throat. "I was heading for the other side of the park, but they've been hunting me, and I got turned around. I didn't mean to come here, but I'm out of food, and my arm is broken, and my foot, and you have to help me, Mira, please." Mira was bewildered. "What?" she said. "What are you talking about? Tony, listen to me," he said, hopping slightly to adjust his weight against the trunk. "Robert Lemoyne is not building a bunker. That's not what he's doing here. He's mining the national park. He's mining Kodawai. That's collusion. It's him and the government and Darvish, Owen Darvish. They're doing it in secret, and they're breaking like 1,000 different laws. And you have to get me to a lab so I can get these photos printed, and I can blow it all wide open. We can't go to the police. We can't involve anybody else. It's too... Mira, this is the biggest fucking... Listen, just listen. Just listen to me, please." "What photos?" Mira said. He dropped the flask, then took a Ziploc bag out of his jacket pocket and held it up. The bag unfurled to show a stubby grey-capped cylinder at the very bottom, a roll of film. Thrusting it at her, he said, "Mira, listen. There is a massive, totally secret, totally illegal mining operation going on right behind these mountains, right now, inside the national park. Do you hear me? I found out about it. I broke in and took these photos." He shook the bag. "And now they're trying to kill me to shut me up. I had to jump into a river, and I left the car. It's Veronica's car. I left it with the keys in it. It doesn't matter. I just need to get these photos developed. I need to get this story out, because this is a fucking international conspiracy at the highest fucking level, and the whole park is like crawling with drones." Mira wondered if he might be going mad. "Slow down," she said. "Just slow down a second. I don't understand. What are you even—" "They've been hunting me," he said. "All week. They have to fly low because of the trees. I've heard them combing back and forth. I can't move at night because the air's too cold. The contrast with my body heat, they'd see me. But when it rains, they don't work as well. There's guys too, guys with guns. I mean, this is—" "And you can't use your phone. You have to stop using your phone, because that's—" "Listen, just listen."
"I'm listening," Mira said.
"Listen to me," Tony said, seeming almost on the verge of tears. "I spoke to Owen Darvish to interview him about the bunker, about Robert Lemoyne, but he wouldn't talk to me. And then he must have told Lemoyne that I'd called, and he had my number. And I realized that's how they knew that I—" "Mira, listen. Everything you said at Burnham Wood, at the Hui, like, about the bunker, and how he'd bought this place, this whole farm. He hasn't. The property never sold, because Darvish is in on it, do you see? It's all a fucking front for this other massively illegal thing they're doing in the national park, and they're in on it together." "But Robert hated Owen Darvish," Mira said, realizing only after she'd spoken that she'd called Lemoyne by his first name. "He told me.
He said he was a little prick.
Mira, you can't trust him, Tony said. That's what I'm telling you. He can't trust a word he says. He's lying to you.
He said he'd put down a deposit, and he was slow walking the deal because of—
No, Tony said. Mira, no. Everything he's told you is a lie.
How long have you been out here? Mira said, meaning Thorndyke generally, but he answered as though she meant the farm.
Since yesterday, he said. I saw you working in the early evening, and I was about to come down, but then I saw the SUV and I chickened out. He's a bad fucking guy, Mira. They tried to run me off the road with that thing, and it's not just him. This is what I'm saying, it's Darvish, it's the fucking government. I mean, this mining site, these chemicals, when you see—
Stop, Mira said. Slow down. What SUV?
The one that drove up to the house last night, said Tony.
What?
She said. And then I saw somebody with a head torch, he said, walking. Later on.
Mira was shaking her head.
Wait, she said. I don't— Why do you think they gave Darvish the knighthood? Tony said wildly. Mira, this goes all the way to the— I can show you the photos. This mining site, the scale of it. And there are soldiers, guards, and— Please, just get me to a lab and I'll show you the photos and you'll see. I know I sound insane. If I were you, I'd be thinking, I don't know. But if there was ever a moment in your life when you had to make a choice, Mira, it's right now. It's this choice, right now, right here. Please help me. I'm not crazy. I'm telling you the truth, I swear to God.
Mira opened her mouth to say something, but she couldn't speak. A weird sensation was building inside her. She had never considered that Owen Darvish had been anything other than an innocent. But if what Tony was saying was the truth, then maybe he'd actually deserved to die. Maybe he'd been a terrible person. Maybe he'd been a criminal. Maybe he'd been a traitor and a thief. Maybe Lemoyne had helped to cover up his death not because of Shelley, not to save her, nor Burnham Wood, not to protect himself, but to protect something else entirely, to hide some vast conspiracy that Mira hadn't known about, that she couldn't possibly have known about, that nobody had known about. She felt as though her chest was about to burst. For this would mean there really was a villain. There really was someone monstrous and more despicable than her. This would mean that she was safe. She could tell the world the truth. She could say she'd been coerced into doing what she did, and people would believe her. People would forgive her. Because Lemoyne was worse than she was, and Darvish had been worse than she was, and the government was worse than she was. It was all a huge conspiracy. Everything was going to be all right.
Mira, Tony said. Say something.
Almost without thinking, she said, He's dead.
What?
Tony said. Darvish, she said. He died on Friday night. His car went off a cliff. Tony gaped at her.
Oh, Jesus, he said, clutching at his hair. Mira, that's what they tried to do to me. They tried to run me off the road. This is— Oh my God, Jesus, fuck. This is exactly what I'm telling you.
And all at once, Mira knew that she was going to help him.
Stay here,
she said, picking up the flask. I'm going to go and get the van. I need to fill it up anyway. I'll come back to get you, and you can hide in the back, and I'll drive you out, and I'll just say I'm going to fill it up and nobody will know, all right?
Don't use your phone, he said. They can't track you if it's in metal. Don't take it out, and don't say anything to anyone.
I won't, she said. Wait here, I'll be back.
Wait, he said, reaching for her. Just wait a second.
She was already backing away.
Don't move, she said, starting to run. I'll be right back. Wait, he called out. Mira.
She stopped. Yeah, she said. He seemed much smaller suddenly. He took a breath.
What? She said. I'm sorry, he said, about my leaving party. I never wanted—
Never wanted what? Mira said when he didn't go on.
I just—
His nose was streaming. He wiped it with the back of his hand.
I just feel like I fucked it up,
he said at last. She felt a rush of benevolence towards him. You didn't fuck it up, she said.
I fucked it up.
Tony tried to smile.
No, you hang up first, he said.
She laughed aloud, buoyed by a crazy feeling of impunity. She felt she might explode with relief and gratitude.
Tony, she said, smiling, coming back to take his hand. We're fine. Honestly, we're totally fine. We were just young.
Yeah, he said, looking down at her clean hand and his dirty one. We were young.
She squeezed his fingers and released them. Stay here, she said. I'll be back.
Bring some food, he said, and painkillers, and be careful.
She set off running down the hill, still smiling. But when she came around the house and the valley seemed to open out before her, she faltered and the smile fell from her face. For in the few short hours that she had been weeding in the upper paddocks, the lower fields had been transformed into a worksite. The main gate at the bottom of the hill was standing open, and crawling up the driveway was a train of heavy vehicles. 18-wheelers loaded with shipping containers, diggers, earth movers, kit-set mobile offices, RVs. She heard engine noise through the rain and turned in bewilderment to see Lemoyne's dark-tinted SUV driving across the field towards her, windscreen wipers flashing, the suspension bouncing on the uneven ground. It drew level with her, and the passenger window slid down.
I came to rescue you, said Lemoyne. Some rain.
She stared at him.
I think your phone must have died, he said. I was trying to call. What's wrong?
Mira couldn't speak. What is all this? She said at last, gesturing around her.
It's my bunker, said Lemoyne,